then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 22nd, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
Let's begin this week with a quick email or two, since I've been falling behind on them lately. This is from European Man. Dear HAC, hi there. Before I go on with my email, I'd just like to say that I'm 100% for what you're doing, and I agree with the entire Northwest solution for our people. I'm just in doubt about something. In the Butler Plan, four phases, it's clearly stated that we should avoid terms such as Aryan, but yet that word is mentioned at the very front page of northwestfront.org. It also says that certain symbols should be avoided, but yet the NVA logo features the 1488 wording. Isn't that a bit contradicting? Dear European Man, okay, by and large, you are correct. I tend to, well, not avoid, but de-emphasize certain words, ideas, and symbols, mostly having to do with National Socialism for a variety of reasons. And yes, normally, Aryan is one of them. Let me repeat that. These words and ideas and symbols need to be de-emphasized and kept in low profile, but in most cases, not necessarily abolished or hidden away altogether. It is a mistake, basically, to confront Americans with anything by way of words or symbols or ideas that you have to stop and explain, especially anything that is or sounds foreign, because that's where you lose them. Americans have never been well educated, and they're not well educated at all today, not even as well as they were 50 years ago when I went through the public schools. Americans don't really believe that history actually happened and that those were real people back then. History is just something you have to learn in school and forget about. Not even much of that in public school these days, and what there is taught there is usually wrong. For example, most Americans don't even know that there was a Korean War unless they're old enough to remember the TV series MASH. They don't learn about it in school. Most Americans can only name four or five presidents prior to the ones that they remember personally in their own lives, and those are the ones on money. Now, you'd be surprised how many Americans believe Benjamin Franklin was a president, since he's on the $100 bill. Now, for Americans, there is no past. There's only here and now. They have no concept at all of the very idea of historical context for a word or an idea or a symbol, and they wouldn't understand it if you tried to explain it to them. Americans don't do complexity, and they don't do nuance. They want their politics like they like their fast food, crated up in cardboard and styrofoam, and guaranteed 100% nutrition-free, all grease and salt and taste. In order to communicate with Americans, your rap has to have a repetitive flow, like a drumbeat. Two or three very simple ideas, little more than slogans really, played over and over and over again at varying tempos and volumes so that these ideas slowly sink into the skulls full of mush. Now, you must never, ever interrupt the drumbeat, the flow, by stopping to explain something. especially something that they simply don't have the background to understand and which would in turn require even more abstruse and historical explanation, so forth and so on, you will lose them after the second sentence if you try. And you can see their eyes glaze over as their sluggish and cholesterol-clogged brains shut down. Now, this is one reason that we've stepped back somewhat on words like Aryan and swastikas and mention of the Führer, Adolf Hitler, etc., etc. But all that having been said, that doesn't mean that we need to accept this level of ignorance on the part of our own people. It doesn't mean that we can't at least begin the process of slowly trying to spoon-feed small amounts of truth into the skulls full of mush. A good example is that NVA seal that you mentioned with 1488 on it. I presume that you're talking about the one from the cover of the Brigade. The NVA is a fictional organization. It doesn't exist. The Brigade is a novel. It's fiction. It's not kind of in the mainstream of ideas that we have to simplify. And so a fictional work is a good way to quietly start slipping a little bit of complexity, a little bit of nuance, a little bit of polemic background, you might say, into the skulls full of mush. Now, this is one of the things that people in our movement find so frustrating and enraging year after year, decade after decade, trying to get through to these stupid, stupid people and get them to see a little bit of light at the bottom of the toilet that they spend their whole lives staring down. Now, if I can anticipate this week's Brandenburg lecture a little bit, believe me, I understand this incredible frustration. It's one of the things that burns our people out. It's one of the things that flips our people out. It makes them bitter. It makes them cynical. Trying year after year to pound some sense into these skulls full of mush. And if we ever did get our act together and get into an NVA-type situation, I think we'd also find that it's a lot easier to convey to people what we want, what we're about, and to get them to pay attention when you're shooting people. Instead of trying to convince these morons, we hopefully would find ourselves in a situation where we can knock them in the head with a baseball bat and tell them, just do what you're told. We know. You don't. Anyway, like I said, we'll leave that later for the Brandenburg. So yeah, you'll still find that we let slip the occasional Aryan and the occasional reference to the Führer. One of the things that we need to be doing in our personal recruiting efforts, which every one of you ought to be engaged in at any given time, is to steer people towards books, websites, and other people who can begin to chip away at the wall of ignorance in their brains and start the process of enlightening their minds with the real truth and the knowledge of who they are and why things are the way they are today. Unfortunately, we live in an age when truth is so rare that it sometimes has to be rationed.
Hey guys, this is Axis Sally. I was informed from my good friend Morris Dees from the Southern Poverty Law Center that Ken Mieske recently died in an Oregon prison. Seriously, I get emails from Morris Dees all the time thanking me for being a friend in the fight against bigotry and extremism. You're welcome, Morris. Just doing my part. I wanted to discuss this because I'm sure some of our listeners may remember this man who was given a life sentence for manslaughter due to hate crime laws. I know he did plead guilty to murder after several hours of questioning, but even the literature that is written by the Jews does not state he intended to kill anyone. For those of you who don't know, Ken Mieske was part of a group of Portland skinheads known as East Side White Pride, and he was convicted along with two others in the beating death of an Ethiopian immigrant. It was one of those incidents of typical teenage behavior that became unintentionally deadly, yet of course if the races were reversed and some blacks beat up a white kid, no one would be in jail, and the families of the black kids could have sued the police department. I do not wish to eulogize Ken Mieske. I did not know him, and I don't agree with his actions. Regardless of how much you hate niggers, random assaults on individual ones do nothing to further our cause and are not heroic actions. There is nothing impressive about three white kids beating up one unarmed nigger. I got a letter recently from a young inmate imploring us to stop judging him for his past actions. He said that he had learned from his mistakes and wanted to be of service to our cause when he was released, but didn't want to be stereotyped as a typical inmate. I told this young man what I tell everyone. I do not care what you have done in the past. Not a bit. If the white nationalist movement is going to restrict membership only to those who have never done one thing that looks bad, I cannot think of one single person in this movement who would still be with us. We have all screwed up at some point. What I'm interested in now is what you are doing today to serve the movement. Simply put, the white race is facing certain death in the next century, so we can't afford to turn away inmates and others with blemishes on their life records. If you will work for us, we will take you. So I explained to him that I, personally, did not judge him for being a convicted felon. I judge him for being 22 years old. With only a few years left to serve, what do you really want to do upon your release? Come to the Northwest and get a boring menial job and do more boring stuff with Harold and I at the Northwest Publishing Agency? Or blah, 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 video games, blah, blah, ultimate fighting, beer and chicks and boots, boots, boots. How many stupid pairs of shoes do you need, you fag? Maybe instead of blowing your whole paycheck at Arianeware, you could buy some work clothes and a car that will run for a while, even if this won't impress your buddies or any girls. Oh, and you know what ultimate fighting is? Niggers punching each other. If this is what you like to watch in your spare time, and if you wear stupid baggy shirts with team logos on them, I hope you end up back in prison or dead very soon. You look like a retarded wigger, and you are worthless subhuman trash. I'm guessing your parents didn't really plan for you. Trouble is, you'll probably find a lot more support for being a retarded wigger than you will for being a responsible, hard-working family man. Harold often wonders what he has to do to get you all to come here, and I think we have the answer. Provide the damn bunkhouse, and the beer, and the stupid TV with your dumbass nigger sports. Of course, that's just a start. We need to redefine working for the cause of Northwest independence to actually mean spending your free time drunkenly beating up anything that's not white, playing stupid music with your equally dumb buddies, ignoring any children you may have in favor of fighting over whose ugly tattoo is better. In other words, just be yourselves, guys. If that's what we asked of you and what we provided for you, we'd have no problem getting you all here. Harold says he needs only 1,000 people to make this happen. Right idea, but still wrong. If we actually had 1,000 of you white power retards all in one space, nothing would get done because half of you would kill each other over whose dumb little skinhead gang is better or what color boots you have on or something even stupider, and the other half would accuse each other of being Jews or informants and would spend their time bickering like little girls over who said what on Stormfront. This is why our movement is really one giant stagnation. What would we have accomplished if white people turned their hatred on their enemies rather than each other? Trouble is, most young white people think that by doing like Ken did, they are making themselves heroes in the eyes of everyone else, and they're not. Turn your hatred on our enemies by being better than they are. A white person. White people are supposed to be better than everyone else, right? Act like it. Get a job, move out of your mom's house, dress like a white person and not a nigger. Spend your time with your children and not your retarded friends. Quit posting on Stormfront about what a badass Nazi you are. No one is impressed. Try learning to read and spell, too. Funny how so many of us complain about Mexicans not speaking English when they come here, yet those proud white warriors who were born here are often practically illiterate and don't seem to care. I will always believe in quality over quantity. We will get a lot more done with 100 non-losers than 1,000 losers. And we will do nothing but move forever backward if we try to work with losers who turn on other white people. Such losers need to be removed from the equation permanently, hung from lampposts like the ugly niggers they really are. If you have ever called the police on a fellow white nationalist, you are a loser. If you have ever promoted disunity among whites, violated the 14 words by harming or threatening white families, or engaged in any sort of retaliation against those of us who actually work for our race, you are lower than the lowest nigger. You are possibly even at Jew level. You need to kill yourself now. Among our great white leaders, whom do you most admire? Many will say Adolf Hitler, David Lane, Robert Matthews. Can you imagine Adolf Hitler sitting in front of a computer for 16 hours a day, getting in little catfights with other losers? Would David Lane have judged Robert Matthews on where he bought his boots? My heroes are those white men who understand that when our race is facing real extinction in the next few generations, we just don't have time for garbage. The Northwest will be won by true Aryan men, not bickering schoolgirls who kill each other over shoelaces and tattoos and try to win every little pissing contest. You are an embarrassment to our race, and I hope you die. So, to the 22-year-old who thinks he's a serious white nationalist and above all that, there's no reason you can't be, even if in the past you were once like that. You can live differently and start living for your race rather than the respect of your buddies. We all can. Though it's highly possible we may end up in prison on trumped-up federal charges, we don't have to end up in prison for doing something stupid like beating a nigger with a baseball bat. If this is how you spend your time, you are no hero, you are a giant waste, and I'm embarrassed to share a white skin with you. I'm also embarrassed that this behavior often continues well past the age of 22. It also does not reside only in the men of this movement. Women are susceptible as well. And this is why we are all going to die out very soon, leaving nothing behind to this practically non-existent movement. But at least you will have really made some good points on all those dumb forums you love so much.
By the way, speaking of historical context, Axis Sally's new theme music there is a song called Lily Marlene, which is probably the only memorable song to come out of World War II. It was sung by all of the sides in the conflict, and I've heard versions of the song in the original German, which we played for you just now, but also in English, in French, and Italian. Now, Lily Marlene was the theme music used by the original Axis Sally during the war, when she was broadcasting from Berlin, who, for those of you who aren't as up on history as you might be, was a very brave young American woman named Mildred Gillers. I dug up that version for our Sally, and she liked it, so we'll probably let that be her theme music from now on. Speaking of music for Sally, I know she also likes white noise rock. I'm sorry, I don't know who this is. It came out of that one big folder of music files that I was sent a while back, and either the sender forgot to mention the actual bands, or more likely, in one of my senior moments, I somehow forgot to make a note of them when I downloaded them, and for that I apologize. I'm sure somebody will recognize this and let me know who it is. Anyway, the song is called Storm Brewing.
Militant right-wingers, in their thousands, and confronting the police. They had come to leave the whole of South Africa in no doubt that, if necessary, they would fight for white self-determination rather than be subjected to an ANC-dominated government. First with sledgehammers, and then with an armored vehicle for a battering ram, they stormed the World Trade Center. Politicians scattered as neo-Nazis armed with pistols and shotguns clambered up stairs and along corridors to occupy the building.
Start the war that day or that night.
Dear Mr. Covington, I am a 16-year-old boy living in Colorado. I found this movement after doing some internet research about stopping the flood of Browns into America. I'm writing this email in the hopes that you can give me some tips and guidelines on how best to serve the Northwest Movement. Currently, I plan to become an officer in the U.S. military in order to obtain certain skills that would be beneficial to the movement, and then move to the homeland after I feel I've learned all I can. I would appreciate any tips you may have that you're not able to broadcast on your podcast. I have already followed some of your advice about reading books more than being around electronics and finding an outdoor hobby, and I found them very helpful. Any advice that you could provide would be much appreciated. Signed, Jake. Dear Jake, first off, thanks for the email. It's always encouraging for me to receive feedback from people of your age. It's nice to know that we're not all a bunch of geriatrics in the movement. Sometimes I wonder. I do have one comment on your future plans that you describe, and that is that when you get older, I think you'll see that the United States military is no longer the place for you or any other white male. For one thing, they don't want you anymore, Jake. You're the wrong color and the wrong gender. As you may be aware, last week they finally eliminated Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was just about the one remaining policy that kept the military one of the last remaining vestiges of the old ways and the old decencies. It is now no longer possible for a young white man to join the military and take a shower in the barracks in safety, and don't even get me started as to what the Navy's going to be like. Plus, there's the general lowering of recruitment standards so that now, in basic training, you will be meeting drug addicts, criminals, sexual deviants, and gangbangers. And your fellow trainees will be even worse. I know the old saw about how we're going to need disillusioned veterans and all that, but I can no longer recommend for any young white person to become involved with the U.S. military in any way. Plus, there's the chance that, as things are right now, you'll probably be shipped right to Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya, just out of basic, and maybe come back in a body bag or minus an arm or a leg. Yeah, I know, I've mentioned before that I myself went into the Army at age 17, but that was many years ago, and I had no choice because my deranged father threw me out of the house. And as bad as the Army was back then, it's far, far worse today. There is no question in my mind that as little as I've accomplished in my life, I could have done so much more if I had been able to earn a living when I was younger at something above a subsistence level. Forget about running around in the desert going bang bang, Jake. There's nothing heroic about it. The real military is a politically correct tyranny, even worse than civilian life. And anyway, why do you want to become a hired murderer for the Jews? To be frank, if I had it all to do over again, I would follow the advice that I myself give to all young people your age, Jake. Stay in school, preferably a technical school of some kind. Learn a trade and get yourself a marketable skill, preferably something that involves fixing the rich man's toys when they break so that you'll always work. I've always wished that I had learned a lot more about auto mechanics, for example. I personally think every white boy should major in auto shop in high school. If you're into computers, forget IT and software crap and video games design. Learn hardware repair so you can actually fix the machines themselves when they go down. Forget pure science unless you're a genuine genius. Funds for pure science are melting away and will probably never come back. You may have read recently that Obama has, for all practical purposes, shut down NASA, for example. There's not going to be any more space travel anytime soon. Learn to be an engineer, someone who can build things, or more urgently, fix things in the infrastructure as it crumbles. Like, say, a lineman for the electric company. The power grid is going to be breaking down more and more, and if you're one of the guys who can patch it and keep it running for a few more months, you'll always work. Above all, if you can handle it, get into the medical field and learn to take care of old people because most of the white population is going to be elderly soon. And frankly, I'd rather we not all be fobbed off onto Filipinos and Nigerians in whatever state-run nursing home the Democrats set up for us as a kind of string of concentration camps. Anything medical, anything to do with caring for old people, and you can write your own ticket. Okay, remember Al, the guy we had on a few weeks ago who described his Northwest scouting trip and job hunt, and who told me that he'd be out here in the homeland before the new year? Well, guess what? He's Al from Idaho now. He's still settling in, but he did find time to make another audio file for us.
To all white men of courage, keeping and bearing arms plays an enormous part in white history and white culture. Why is this? I believe that part of the answer is that white societies are capable of handling firearms without breaking down into local warlords and strongmen. MUDs can't, be they ghetto niggers or be they suburban gooks. As a race capable of controlling our emotions and impulses, most of us can carry guns without shooting anyone who flips us the bird or who cuts us off in traffic. Free men keep and bear arms, while slaves are disarmed by their masters because free men are capable of handling the responsibility in a civilized manner. For reasons of preparedness, it is important for us to own and train with weapons. When you come to the Northwest, some states are better than others about not interfering with an armed lifestyle. I won't hold you in suspense. Idaho and Montana are far and away better than Washington and Oregon for the armed migrant. The importance of staying legal and compliant until we have the power to enforce our own laws cannot be understated. Therefore, if you are active in the gun community, consider the gun regulations you will have to obey as one factor in your relocation decision. I'll be making several observations about regulation of weapons in the Northwest states, but please bear in mind, I'm not a lawyer. Am not offering legal advice, am not attempting to restate the law, and am basing my observations on research from organizations like the NRA and Brady Campaign. Personally verify any legal dimensions that impact your own situation, because you, not I, will end up paying the price for breaking the rules, and it would be too much for me to cover every county sheriff in the Northwest and track all of the pending court cases in this quick broadcast. The NRA and the Brady Campaign are two organizations on the opposite ends of the political spectrum, but they have the most comprehensive state-to-state comparisons that I know of. The Bradys are worth looking at with a worse-is-better perspective. The worse they consider a state, the friendlier it is for gun owners. The Brady Bunch considers Idaho and Montana second to last for their lack of regulation, at 2 points each out of a possible 100. Only Alaska, Arizona, and Utah are worse, with 0 points each. At the other end, Oregon and Washington have 17 points each. By the Brady ranking system, 11 other states are more restrictive than the coastal Northwest, starting with Michigan at 25 points and ending with California at 80 points. Idaho receives 2 points because it has not enacted campus carry laws restricting colleges against prohibiting carry on their premises. Montana's 2 points come from its lack of workplace protection laws restricting employers against prohibiting employees from having firearms in company parking lots. Washington gets points from the Bradys for, among other things, requiring a state license to purchase firearms, keeping and retaining purchase records from dealers, and reporting everything to the state, including ammunition sales. Oregon is similar to Washington, but doesn't keep quite as many records. They do, however, require background checks even at gun shows, which is worth 7 points to the Bradys. A Brady would clearly prefer Washington or Oregon. Now we'll switch to more NRA-related information. There is far more to state firearms regulations than concealed carry, but it's as good a place as any to start. Some people choose to carry concealed without a license, but I don't recommend it. The penalties if you get caught by master are staggering. The old man wants us out of jail, working for the 14 words, so let's not get behind bars for doing things that don't even hurt the occupation government. The good news is that all four Northwestern states are shall-issue right-to-carry states, meaning that unless the government has a specific reason not to issue a permit, such as an existing restraining order, previous felony, or renunciation of citizenship, they must give you one. According to the NRA, Idaho charges $20 for a 5-year permit and $15 for a renewal. Montana charges $50 for a 4-year permit and $25 for a renewal. Oregon charges $65 for a 4-year permit and $50 for a renewal. Washington charges $60 for a 5-year permit each time. But contact the county sheriff to find out for sure, because I found the NRA sometimes has a slight lag. Unfortunately, one state permit will not give you unfettered access to carry in all Northwestern states. Idaho recognizes permits from any state, period. 26 states recognize Idaho permits, but in the Northwest, only Montana does. Montana recognizes permits from most states, including Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. In the Northwest, however, only Idaho recognizes a Montana permit. Oregon doesn't recognize permits from any other state. Only a few other states recognize an Oregon permit, but Idaho and Montana make that list. Washington only recognizes permits from a few other states, none of which are in the Northwest. Idaho and Montana recognize a Washington permit. If you don't want others to know about your concealed carry license, two Northwest states protect your confidentiality, Idaho and Washington. Oregon and Montana do not have confidentiality provisions in their concealed carry laws, which means that it is theoretically possible that records of permit holders could be made public. Okay, so you've got a license. You still can't carry freely anywhere you want. When it comes to restaurants serving alcohol, Washington and Montana are classified by the NRA as having a partial ban, while Idaho and Oregon have no restrictions. All of the Northwestern states recognize the right to carry in state parks, although this is something to look into if you are licensed to carry in any other state. All Northwestern states allow permit holders to carry on college campuses, but also allow universities to set their own policies. You won't be held criminally liable for carrying on campus, but the university can legally take academic disciplinary action if it finds out a student is packing on school grounds in violation of their policy. Idaho protects your right to keep a gun in your car on company property, but the other states do not. Therefore, employers can set their own policy in those states. If they have a policy against weapons on company grounds, they can take disciplinary action if you bring them onto their property in Oregon, Washington, or Montana. Even so, don't make yourself conspicuous in any respect, and don't stick your neck out to prove a point when someone else is holding all of the strings. In other words, don't be the only guy with a rifle rack in the back window of your pickup truck. If a dozen other people at your worksite do it, then you're all right, as long as you put your Remington bolt gun back there instead of your tricked-out AR. Now, we'll move on to two other important factors in a state's legal climate, Castle Doctrine and emergency powers. Castle Doctrine is one of the most important laws a state can have. The Castle Doctrine removes the duty to retreat, wherein, if you can retreat from someone attempting to invade your property using deadly force, you must. Duty to retreat means that unless you are backed into a corner of your basement and cannot flee, you must not fight back. In a Castle Doctrine state, the fact that someone is invading your home is justification in itself for the use of deadly force. The NRA says Idaho and Montana are Castle Doctrine states, while Washington and Oregon are not. Be careful, though. Other sources identify Idaho as a weak Castle Doctrine state, based mostly on case law and less on legislation. Keep in mind that even in a Castle Doctrine state, deliberately antagonizing or threatening others is probably not a good idea. If it can be shown in court that you started it or were looking for a fight, Castle Doctrine might not be good enough to get you off scot-free just because you jump into your car. Some of you might recall the Louisiana gun confiscation after Hurricane Katrina. At issue is the emergency powers of the state against the right to keep and bear arms. Several states have specific emergency powers legislation forbidding the confiscation of firearms and the suspension of the right to keep and bear arms in a declared emergency. Among them are Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. Washington has no such law. My observation is that in the U.S., we have such a strong culture of compliance with authority that the law really doesn't matter so much when the shit hits the fan. A jury of your American peers will expect you to just comply with police officers and military personnel, regardless of whether they were actually acting lawfully. So until we have rights once again that we fought and died for, don't base your decisions upon whatever you think your rights are. If you are a white heterosexual, you are a second-class citizen and have no rights any authority figure is bound to respect. So today we've reviewed concealed carry laws, Castle Doctrine, and emergency powers legislation. Idaho and Montana are clearly at the favorable end of state interference with the right to keep and bear arms. However, while Oregon and Washington are more restrictive, they should be tolerable for most people. This is only a cursory overview of an extremely complicated subject, and the impact of state gun regulations will depend upon your personal situation. Speaking of which, when you drive northwest with your guns, Check the laws of the states you'll be passing through, and then avoid Illinois, and whatever you do, stay out of Chicago. Finally, consider that the role of federal regulation has been growing. Someday, national legislation may be enacted that makes state laws a moot point. That scenario is entirely consistent with the direction the occupation government is headed. That's it for today, comrades. Remember, all things are ready if our minds be so. I'll see you in the Northwest.
Okay, after that, I looked around for a good gun song. I've already played The Devil's Right Hand by Waylon Jennings, and I was going to play Saturday Night Special by Lynyrd Skynyrd, but although that's a hell of a song, it's also kind of anti-gun. So eventually I came up with this one. This is The Wolf Tones. And it's time, once again, for our weekly Brandenburg Lecture here on Radio Free Northwest. Now, that's the name I've given to this series of little talks wherein we discuss the ins and outs, purely theoretical, of course, of what might be termed non-consensual regime change in Washington, D.C. You know, the kind of non-consensual regime change they experienced in this country in 1776, in France in 1789, in Russia in 1917, in Germany in 1933, and in Iran in 1979. Now, these discussions are made possible by the 1969 landmark Supreme Court ruling Brandenburg v. Ohio, hence the name. Now, this stated that it is perfectly legal and constitutional to talk about regime change in this country, just so long as nobody actually tries to change anything, and as long as nobody annoys the people with power too badly, in which case they'll ignore their own laws. They do that a lot lately. In the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, one of the worst offenses it was possible to commit was to speak of the death of the king. Now, that's the kind of talk that could get you hanged, drawn, and quartered, or literally boiled in oil in some cases. In essence, this is what I'm doing with these Brandenburg lectures. I am speaking of the death of the king, the end of America as we have known it for the past 50 years, well, hell, past 100 years. And Jesus Christ, it's high time this monstrosity came crashing down. Things in the world today have become so hideous that the end of America is a moral necessity if there is ever to be any hope remaining for all of mankind, never mind just the white man. Back in the 1890s, the degenerate Pommy aristocrat Lord Alfred Douglas was Oscar Wilde's bugger boy. In one of his poems, Douglas referred to homosexuality as the love that dare not speak its name. There's a topic which the white nationalist movement similarly has for years discussed only in whispers, and it's time we came out of the closet and openly discussed armed insurrection against the tyrants in Washington, D.C., the racial struggle that dare not speak its name. Some people have asked me over the past couple of weeks if I've lost my mind. No, just my patience. I have simply had it with trying to talk around this issue for the past 40 years for fear that some FBI asshole or some U.S. attorney trying to win a little gold star on his or her forehead will take it upon himself or herself that the United States Constitution doesn't apply to me. These people think that they're above the law and that I am beneath it. Well, fuck 'em. Direct action to achieve genuine change in the society has been the 2,000-pound elephant in the movement's living room for all that time, a large pachyderm we all know full well is right there in front of us, but which everybody is simply too polite to mention while Grandma pours the tea and passes out the cookies, or more accurately, that everybody is too terrified to mention. Look, it's like this. I have opinions on things, and I'm tired of not saying them. And after 40 years of this crap, I've just had enough. For once, I am going to say what I mean. And if that lands me in a cell next to Edgar Steele, at least in my case, they'll be arresting the right guy, and they won't have to fabricate a bunch of stupid bogus audio recordings of me trying to hire a janitor as a hitman or something equally absurd. Now let's face it, folks. We should have been slaughtering these bastards a long time ago. In my personal opinion, the proper time for armed and forcible resistance came in 1958, when Eisenhower ordered troops into Little Rock to force a policy of racial integration on the white people of the South that we did not want and which we had done everything democracy demanded to prevent, only to be ignored and spat on by the tyrants in Washington, D.C. The Confederate States of America should have been reestablished, and we should have had a rematch of what happened in 1861. And maybe this time the good guys would have won, and we wouldn't have all these terrible and life-threatening problems that we have today. And by the way, guys, one quick caveat. Regardless of what you hear on here from me gassing away about making things go boom and making Humpty Dumpty have a great fall, I strongly caution you to remember, whether or not the regime decides to let these Brandenburg lectures pass or to stage the first actual thought crime trial in many years in this country, this is me taking on the beast. Let me do it. It's what you pay me the big bucks for. Remember that our friends in the silk suits are still out there plying their revolting trade. Beware of any person or group who approaches you with some alleged plan for armed insurrection or premature illegality, possibly citing these Brandenburg lectures as some kind of imprimatur from me. They'll be lying. Anyone who does this is either a dangerous idiot or else a police agent of some kind. If you fall for their line, then you're an idiot. It's an ironic truism that, to some degree, federal agents provocateur provide the movement with a grim form of natural selection, whereby those who are too stupid to become genuine revolutionaries are weeded out. Don't you be one of the weeds. Now let's say it again. We should have been slaughtering these bastards a long time ago. Everybody knows it, and everybody knows that the reason we haven't been doing so is not out of any political or tactical considerations, but quite simply, we're too chicken shit. We think more of our own safety than we do of our honor. We think more of our wealth and our personal possessions than we do of our children. And for that, we deserve everything that has been done to us over the past three generations. Cowards and dumbasses deserve no sympathy, although their children certainly do. Now, can we change that? Sure. We could change it all tomorrow, if we wanted to. It wouldn't be hard. This system we live under is weak, tottering, and their goons really aren't that tough. Now, we're talking about paramilitary forces who burned children alive at Waco, who shot down a little boy and a mother with a baby in her arms in her home at Ruby Ridge, and who deliberately fabricated audio tapes in order to make an elderly man of 66 in poor health die in prison out of, near as anybody can figure, sheer malice. Now, these are not the actions of a strong and efficient system that is confident in its own right to rule. These are not the actions of strong, brave men. They're the contemptible acts of contemptible cowards who hurt people for money. They're the hired muscle who keep our oppressors in power. And one of these days, their direct deposits are going to stop coming, and they're going to vanish like the morning dew. I honestly don't think that all these big bad FBI and ATF and other goons in their black body armor have what it takes to stand up to real resistance from real men of the kind that I've known and seen in Rhodesia and Ireland and elsewhere. And I think the first time they come up against organized and determined white men who aren't afraid of them, they'll throw down their weapons and run like they did on the first day at Waco. A little stiffening of our spines, and we could erase the past 70 years if we wanted to. So what, we don't want to? Sure we do. We just can't figure out any way to do it without any risk or inconvenience to ourselves.
Certain of our fearless leaders keep trying to figure out some way to persuade some other poor dumb cluck or clucks to go first. Take all the risk, and if he wins, then fearless leader can step forward and take the credit and reap the rewards of power. And if they lose and get killed or sent to prison for 5,000 years, fearless leader has plausible deniability and he can sit there and keep on selling his CDs and his videos by mail and on the internet. Bear in mind the essential difference between direct action and the stupid illegal act. Direct action is an overt act which inflicts serious damage against the enemy through the loss of important personnel or resources, an act which improves the movement's image as serious revolutionaries to be treated with the respect which comes from the capacity to use force successfully, which demoralizes and confuses the enemy and correspondingly strengthens the morale of the movement and the white population as a whole. Finally, the most critical component of direct action is that the persons carrying it out are not apprehended or punished by the forces of the state. By contrast, the stupid illegal act is usually carried out spontaneously with little or no prior planning, often under the influence of alcohol. It is directed against minor targets such as street niggers, individual faggots or race mixers, etc., who are no real loss to the system, there being plenty more where they came from. Finally, the perpetrators are almost always immediately arrested and given crushing prison sentences, thus boosting the enemy's morale and bolstering the deterrent effect of the establishment's crumbling legal machinery, giving it a gloss of efficiency which it does not in fact possess. Such as it is, the white nationalist movement throughout the world since 1945 has been distinguished by one remarkable characteristic which separates it from every other revolutionary movement ever known, a reluctance verging on the racially suicidal to engage in armed military struggle against genocidal tyranny. Genuine politics is about one thing, the acquisition and exercise of power. All else is political hobbyism, a luxury which the wealthy landed gentry of the 18th and 19th centuries who created liberal democracy could afford, but which a race on the verge of extinction cannot. Power, all power without exception, is in the final analysis founded on one basis, armed force. Religion, constitutions, civil laws, custom, and all the various social institutions for reinforcing acceptable behavior, meaning submission to authority, all have their place in a state's power structure, but without the ultimate sanction of the bayonet, they are meaningless. All power, without exception, is initially acquired through armed force or through the imminent threat of armed force. Some revolutions are bloodier than others. The Bolsheviks slaughtered millions while the National Socialist German Workers' Party came to power in Germany after somewhat less than 1,000 deaths in 14 years of street fighting between the party's paramilitary formations and the communists. But all modern states, without exception, were originally brought into existence by men who fought for power with weapons in their hands. Power becomes accessible to revolutionaries when the existing order loses two vital assets upon which the maintenance of any government depends. The first element is the, at least passive and tacit, consent of the governed, and the second is the credible monopoly of armed force. When the revolutionary movement has both the will and the capacity to commit acts of armed insurrection against the state and to do so with impunity, i.e. the perpetrators are not caught or punished, then the state has lost the credible monopoly of force which is the foundation of all power. Persons other than those sanctioned by the state exercise power over the lives and destinies of others. the revolutionary movement begins to displace the state's apparatus by armed compulsion as well as by transferring the consent of the governed to itself through persuasion and propaganda. Both persuasion and coercion are necessary to carry out a successful revolution. Neither element alone can succeed without the other. All the propaganda, all the popular support, and all the legal activity in the world are useless if the state can fall back on armed force to maintain itself and destroy opposition. A revolutionary movement without an effective armed wing is doomed to perpetual futility and eventual defeat.
The formulations stated above are by no means original with me. They're as old as statecraft itself. I simply happen to be the only American white nationalist who's willing to discuss them in public. Now, these truths are obvious from even the most cursory examination of human history. They're also obvious from reading today's headlines. It is a demonstrable historical fact, pursued with sufficient persistence, ruthlessness, military expertise, and fearless disregard for the consequences, armed struggle eventually works. Why, then, do white males persistently refuse to utilize the gun, the basic tool of power which is understood and applied without hesitation by the most savage African tribal leader and the most corrupt and uncouth Latin American despot? Well, there's common or garden variety cowardice, of course, but it's a little more complex and nuanced than that. There is also the incredible lack of practical political education and knowledge among what passes for white leadership, the bulk of whom are politically and historically illiterate. Your average Ku Klux Klan leader has never cracked a proper history book in his life, and probably thinks Machiavelli is a foreign sports car. To be sure, some prominent movement figures, especially those involved in revisionism, do have a high degree of specialized knowledge within certain very narrow fields, such as constitutional esoterica or the Third Reich period in Germany, something like that. But while they may be able to wax abstruse on obscure points of common law that the federal judiciary of today simply ignores, or they can rattle off the name of every SS division and every Jew who was ever involved in Marxism, by and large, any in-depth historical scholarship is almost entirely lacking within the movement. Our reluctance to face up to the reality of armed struggle's pivotal role in social and political change goes beyond these immediately apparent causes. It reaches into the deep-rooted psychological malaise which has pervaded the entire white racial resistance movement throughout the Western world since 1945. Now, this psychological and spiritual condition is hard to quantify. The late Dr. Revelo Oliver once posed the famous question, have we, the men of the West, lost the will to live? Down through the years, I have often observed that the white man in America seems to be in the grip of a kind of collective death wish, a mysterious and inexplicable will to failure. I am by no means the first to notice this phenomenon. One of the best articles that the late Bob Miles ever wrote was in the aftermath of the Fort Smith sedition trials in 1988, when he pointed out in his From the Mountain newsletter that the acquittals in that despicable charade, instead of heartening us and encouraging more activism, resulted in an avalanche of sullen defeatism, smears, carping, and dog-in-the-manger petty bickering throughout the movement. Bob pointed out something which is crucial to understanding why we have gotten virtually nowhere for the past two generations. Over and above the preponderance of outright fraudulent leadership who are in it for the money, the movement has been controlled for years by elements who are deeply pessimistic, defeatist, lazy, lethargic, and mired in profound depression over the white man's terrible present situation and our even more terrible prospects for the future. We are an army of Eeyores.
It's difficult to assign a precise point where the rot set in. The murder of Commander Rockwell will do for a benchmark, but the fact remains that for almost three decades, the bulk of the white right in North America has been led by men who are simply going through the motions. To be sure, sometimes they have gone through the motions with a certain degree of style and class. Yet with one or two shining exceptions, such as the Saga of the Order, the various attempts at white resistance which have occurred over the past 30 years have always had a dark, sinister undercurrent, the acidly poisonous idea that victory isn't really possible, that the white man is essentially doomed to extinction through his own stupidity, and that the most any of us can really do is to draw the funeral ceremonies and the eulogies out as long as we can before getting on with the business of dying. When this attitude is taken into consideration, the reluctance seriously to discuss, much less to adopt, the one operational strategy 100% guaranteed to catapult us into serious politics in double-quick time becomes comprehensible. Why risk one's life, health, and liberty on what is essentially an interesting but ultimately futile hobby? Because that is exactly how most so-called leaders among us regard the whole exercise in which they are engaged. There are, of course, a number of practical objections to direct action at the moment. Please don't think we're unaware of them. In the first place, we lack anything remotely resembling leadership sufficiently competent to wage a military campaign. Certain so-called leaders among us have occasionally incited their skinhead followers to acts of random violence with hysterical rhetoric about quote-unquote Aryan warriors, but this is just self-destructive hooliganism, not properly organized revolution. Usually the skins who fall into this trap end up doing more damage to themselves and their friends than to the enemy, which may of course be the object of the whole exercise. Almost nowhere in white American males do we find the attributes of the political soldier. The total dedication to the cause, to the exclusion of every personal consideration, the alertness to one's surroundings, which means survival in guerrilla warfare, the cool and steady hand that can pull a trigger at close range and watch the brains splatter or detonate a bomb without fumbling or hesitation, the mental agility necessary to stay one step ahead of the pursuing police and government troops, and above all, the total selfless dedication, the inflexible purpose, the iron self-discipline necessary to function under unbelievable pressure, to stand the unimaginable stress, and to live the life of the modern-day urban guerrilla.
Belfast produces IRA and UVF men. America produces Homer Simpsons and Beavis and Buttheads. My novels are only fiction. And no one knows that better than me, because I've seen the real thing, and we ain't it. During my 25 years in the movement, I have met a few white men with that kind of inflexible will, hardness, courage, and integrity, but only a few. Before we can even think about rebelling against the tyrant, we must produce a different kind of white man in this country. This is not beyond the realm of possibility. I do not, in fact, believe that we ourselves will have to perform this prodigious transmutation. I think Zog is going to do it for us. Because, you see, oppression either breaks men or it makes them. Now, we live in a backed-up toilet, and I'm convinced that eventually even our docile pale faces will finally let the scales fall from their eyes and make the decision that they would rather die than live like this for one more day. And they don't care how many secret policemen are tapping their phones or reading their email or following them around in their black SUVs.
The philosopher Nietzsche said, "That which does not destroy me makes me stronger." The Jews and their leftist allies have turned this country into a revolting, putrid swamp. But dangerous beasts breed in swamps. I think the Jews and the establishment have long suffered from the typical defect which the arrogance of power breeds, an overestimation of their ability to control events. The law is a weapon, and like any other weapon, it is only as good or as bad as the people wielding it. Right now, the law is in the hands of the present United States government and the liberal establishment, one of many such weapons. It is being used to pillage you, disrupt, and break up your family, rob your children of a future, and will eventually destroy you in your old age. The law in its present state deserves no respect from any white man or woman in America. Indeed, obedience and respect for the law have become counter-survival and, human nature being what it is, anything which is counter-survival will not endure. Adolf Hitler himself stated in Mein Kampf, "When a people is being driven to destruction through the instrument of governmental authority, then rebellion is not only the right, but the duty of that people."
Finally, there is the moral dimension to be considered. Looking for easy outs and safe shortcuts is not only futile, it's wrong. Before we can have a new white world, we have to earn it. That's the way life works. Like all persecuted minorities, white people are despised. We're despised by the government that rules us. We're despised by the liberal establishment that looks down its nose at us. We are despised by the Congoid criminals who rob and rape and kill our people like we were beasts of the field. We are despised by the media. And to a large degree, we're despised by our own children. We are despised because we are correctly viewed as weak, cowardly, lazy, incapable, and unwilling to defend ourselves or to take any serious action against those who despoil and victimize us, other than go whining to the enemy's police and the enemy's courts, who don't do jack shit about it and who laugh at us. Why, in the name of God, should anyone respect us? Why should we respect ourselves? Now, it's time that white men recovered our self-respect and the respect of those who hate us. And it is a long-standing human truth that respect among men is earned by the shedding of blood.
Something straight. In one way, these Brandenburg lectures are just theoretical, just me and Harold talking to ourselves on a computer, but in another way, they're not. They're a deadly serious prophecy. The United States of America is going to go down. It may take a long time. It may take another full generation, or it may happen tomorrow morning, but the historical signs are all there, and they've never been wrong for the past few millennia. America will almost certainly go down in flames and in a welter of bloody violence, most likely within the lifetimes of the majority of people now living. The only question is when it will happen. Who will deliver the final kick to the tottering edifice, and who will be the main beneficiary of the USA's collapse? That collapse is coming. Our role in the Northwest is to make sure that white people survive and can save something out of the rubble. This is not a case of anyone inciting to anything, not Harold and not me. It is simply a historical inevitability. The United States is not immune to the realities of human nature or to the pressures of history. Remember last week I quoted de Tocqueville's comment about the average age of great civilizations being 200 years? That's pretty much true, and the USA is long past its sell-by date. The FBI and other secret police can keep the present senile power structure in place for a while longer, but only for a while. Let me ask all you trench coat types out there who are listening to this. What are you going to do the first time you check your bank balance online one month and your direct deposit isn't there? What are you going to do the first time you get the little envelope in your office mailbox and you don't find a pay stub with all your deductions inside, but instead you find some letter of excuse from Obama or the Attorney General explaining why there's no money to pay you this month? Oh, the first time it happens, they'll probably correct it the next month and explain that it was all just an unfortunate glitch somewhere in the system, but how about the next time, and the time after that? What are you going to do when your family is foraging for food in the dumpsters like the families of Soviet soldiers in the 1980s? When that happens, will you really continue to monitor us and harass us and maybe arrest and torture and imprison us when your bosses can't be bothered to pay you? And what will the rest of us do when all of a sudden the Iron Heel really is suddenly released off our necks? Because that's how it will finally happen. The tyranny in Washington will run out of money to pay for their muscle, and without their hired muscle to keep the rest of us in line and keep us obedient, they're nothing. Just a bunch of creeps in expensive haberdashery sitting in offices sending out email memos and intriguing around the water cooler against each other. What will happen when Washington, D.C. just plain becomes irrelevant and people just start plain ignoring them and they've got no muscle to club us into line because either they can't pay their goons or else because Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve has printed up so much funny money to make up for the taxes that aren't being paid anymore that the American dollar is worthless? That will be our window of opportunity, and that is the time we have to be ready for. You need to get ready too. You need to start packing that moving van and getting ready to come to the Northwest homeland while you still can, before you have to flee with nothing but the shirts on your backs like the Horakova family in Harold's latest novel. That time is coming, comrades. Let's make sure it doesn't catch us by surprise, because it could all happen a lot sooner than we think. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Axis Sally, and Harold and I will see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.